Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the December 31st, 2021 Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy. Today I'll be reading the following main articles. Devastating. Hundreds of homes destroyed, tens of thousands forced to flee, by Kieran Nicholson of the Denver Post. Governor reduces truck driver sentence to 10 years, by Elise Schmelzer of the Denver Post. And demand for COVID tests up, by Meg Wingerter, also of the Denver Post. And I'll be following up with miscellaneous articles. Our first story, Marshall Fire, devastating. Hundreds of homes destroyed, tens of thousands forced to flee, by Kieran Nicholson. A wind-whipped grass fire roared east from Boulder on Thursday afternoon, destroying at least 500 homes, closing major highways, and causing the evacuation of more than 30,000 people in two towns, including hospital patients. The Marshall Fire, which officials said likely was sparked by downed power lines in the winds that reached gusts of more than 100 miles per hour, grew to 1,600 acres by 5 p.m., Boulder County Sheriff Joe Pell said in an evening news conference. The end won't come until the wind subsides, Pell said. This is the kind of fire you can't fight head on. More than 200 structures may have been lost to the flames in downtown Superior, including a hotel, he said. More than 300 homes were on fire in a single neighborhood. We are literally watching it burn, Superior Mayor Clint Folsom said in an interview. This is devastating for our people. Images from the area showed apartment buildings and entire neighborhoods engulfed in flames. Thick smoke blanketed the area, prompting officials to caution people against driving because of the diminished visibility. Superior's 12,000 people were the first to be evacuated, followed by Louisville's population of about 20,000. Later in the evening, evacuations widened, and parts of Broomfield were under pre-evacuation orders. A mandatory evacuation order is now in place for everyone south of U.S. 36 to 112th and west of Wadsworth, Broomfield police posted on Twitter. This includes the Interlochen area. If you live in that area, leave immediately. The fast-moving fires had emergency responders scrambling, shutting down roadways as flames jumped the pavement. At one point in the afternoon, Boulder County officials asked the public to stop calling 911 to report trees toppling and vehicles being blown over. Governor Jared Polis declared a state of emergency, citing the dangerous wind-whipped grass fires. The declaration allows the state to access disaster emergency funds to support the emergency response efforts in Boulder and provide state resources, including the use of the Colorado National Guard, Colorado Division of Fire Prevention and Control, and activation of the State Emergency Operations Center, Polis said in a news release. At a 5 p.m. news conference Thursday, he praised emergency responders, many of whom live in the communities that are on fire. First responders live here, not knowing the status of their own home. They are still on the front line, doing everything they can to serve others, Polis said. As of 5:30 p.m., authorities were unaware of any deaths from the fires. We would not be surprised if there are injuries or casualties in the fire still raging after dark, Pell said. A Vista Adventist Hospital in Louisville was evacuated, and patients, including those in the intensive care unit, were transferred to Longmont United Hospital and St. Anthony North Hospital, said Lindsay Radford, a Centura Health spokeswoman. Surgery patients and staffers sheltered in place. Roads around the hospital were closed to the public because of the smoke and fire. UC Health Broomfield Hospital admitted 6 people Thursday who suffered medical problems because of the fires, spokeswoman Kelly Christensen said. Area residents who fled the fire assessed what they had left. Areas of Boulder had been under pre-evacuation orders earlier in the day. Some roads, including Colorado 93, were shut down by the winds and trucks had been toppled. Authorities urged people to stay home and off of area roads, if possible, as a safety precaution. Broomfield went on accident alert because of the damaging winds and the rapidly changing situation. Road closures at one point included U.S. 36 between Boulder and Lyons, but the highway was reopened, in part, to evacuate Superior. But a stretch of the road was closed in both directions, from Interlochen Loop to Baseline Road, because of the fire. Grass fires in Boulder included one in the 5500 block of Broadway sometime after 10 a.m. and another in the 1100 block of Cascade Drive. Firefighters responded and contained both of those fires. Our next story, fatal I-70 crash. Governor reduces truck driver's sentence to 10 years by Elise Schmelzer. Governor Jared Polis on Thursday reduced the sentence from 110 years to only 10 years for the former truck driver convicted of causing a 2019 fatal crash that killed 4 people. Polis called the sentence imposed on Rogel Aguilera Medeiros highly atypical and unjust in his Thursday letter announcing the commutation. Aguilera Medeiros, 26, will be eligible for parole on December 30, 2026. You were sentenced to 110 years in prison, effectively more than a life sentence, for a tragic but unintentional act, Polis wrote in the letter. While you are not blameless, your sentence is disproportionate compared with many other inmates in our criminal justice system who committed intentional, premeditated, or violent crimes. The decision comes after the 110-year sentence imposed 2 weeks ago drew nationwide outrage, and more than 5 million people signed a petition calling on the governor to reduce the sentence. The outcry prompted First Judicial District Attorney Alexis King, whose office prosecuted the case, to request that the judge reconsider the sentence. District Judge Bruce Jones granted the request and scheduled a January 13th hearing to reconsider the sentence, although it is now likely moot. A representative from the governor's office called Aguilera Medeiros and one of his attorneys Thursday afternoon. Aguilera Medeiros defense attorney Jim Colgan said, "The governor never would have intervened had millions of people not voiced their outrage at the sentence," Colgan said. "Justice was done," he said. Aguilera Medeiros lost his brakes while traveling into Denver on Interstate 70 on April 25, 2019. He failed to take a runaway truck ramp before he rammed his speeding semi into stopped traffic under an overpass in Lakewood and caused a 28-car pileup. 6 people were injured in the crash and 4 people died. Miguel Angel Lamas Arellano, 24, William Bailey, 67, Doyle Harrison, 61, and Stanley Politano, 69. King, the district attorney, called Polis' decision disappointing and premature in a statement Thursday night. I joined the surviving victims and families of those who lost their loved ones in their wish to have the trial judge determine an appropriate sentence in this case, as he heard the facts and evidence of the defendant's destructive conduct that led to death, injury, and devastating destruction, King said. We are meeting with the victims and their loved ones this evening to support them in navigating this unprecedented action and to ensure they are treated with fairness, dignity, and respect during this difficult time. King said her office looked forward to releasing information about the case that it could not reveal while the case was proceeding. During his October trial, prosecutors argued that Aguilera Medeiros had several chances to prevent the crash. Aguilera Medeiros knew there was something wrong with his brakes dozens of miles earlier, the prosecutor said. He also drove recklessly hours before the crash. The judge convicted Aguilera Medeiros of 16 first-degree assault and attempted first-degree assault charges. Under Colorado's mandatory minimum sentencing laws, those crimes of violence must be served consecutively, not concurrently. During the December 13th sentencing hearing, Jones said he would have chosen a different sentence if he had the discretion. The sentence prompted calls for rewriting of Colorado's sentencing laws. In his letter, Polis called for reform as well. Polis acknowledged the loss of those killed and the pain suffered by those injured and who lost loved ones, and said Aguilera Medeiros made bad decisions. He urged Aguilera Medeiros to seek restorative justice with the victims and their families. You have wondered why your life was spared when other lives were taken, Polis wrote in his letter. You will struggle with this burden of this event for the rest of your life, but never forget that because of this event, countless others will struggle with the loss of their loved ones or injuries as well, and you will serve your just sentence, he wrote. Demand for COVID tests up. Officials urge people to make appointment or backup plan amid a rise in virus cases by Meg Wingerter. If you want to get tested for the new coronavirus, it's a good idea to schedule an appointment in advance and consider having a backup plan, the head of the state's COVID-19 response said Thursday. On Sunday, testing sites in Westminster and Lone Tree hit capacity and had to turn away some people who did not have appointments. Some health care providers in the Denver area also are booked out into next week, and Governor Jared Polis announced Thursday afternoon that he would send more than 200 National Guard members to assist at testing sites. Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander, said he's heard of isolated incidents, of delays, and of sites having to turn some people away. So it's a good idea to make an appointment to get tested or to look up other options in your area in case the first place you choose can't take any more walk-ins, he said. The state doesn't have public data about how often testing sites can't accommodate people who want to get swabbed. We've seen this big increase in demand in the last few days, he said at a news conference Thursday morning. Bookman also urged patients if lines are longer than expected. Sites have reported that some people waiting to be tested have been verbally abusive to staff, he said. We're all in this together, he said. We're working as hard as we can to keep everyone safe. Chyrese Harris, Vice President of Communications for COVID Check Colorado, said demand for tests is increasing as the Omicron variant spreads, and wait times are somewhat longer than they were a few weeks ago. COVID Check Colorado operates 26 testing sites in the Denver area and 21 in other parts of the state. While we are doing everything we can to meet the needs of patients, staffing shortages are also contributing to longer than normal wait times, which is why we are encouraging individuals to make an appointment online and plan for wait times of about 30 minutes, she said. Kaiser Permanente, which only offers testing to its members, was booked out until January 4th as of Wednesday. Spokesman Nick Roper said officials are working to add slots. "We're pretty glad people are coming in to get tested," he said. While much of the focus has been on the Denver area, more rural parts of the state also are seeing backups. The Northeast Colorado Health Department sent a tweet Wednesday urging residents to make appointments if they want to get tested. The department serves Logan, Morgan, Phillips, Sedgwick, Washington, and Yuma counties. Because of the holidays and Omicron variant quickly spreading, there are longer wait times at testing sites, the department said. A few days before Christmas, Colorado added 6 combination sites, offering both vaccines and testing along the Front Range. Statewide, about 150 sites offer testing, although some have limited hours. More testing sites are scheduled to be closed Saturday, New Year's Day, but Bookman said it's possible some could change their plans and stay open. For anyone who needs to be tested in the next few days, it's best to go Friday morning before the incoming snowstorm could force sites to close, he said. The state's program to distribute rapid tests also has slowed down in the past week. It got off to a rocky start in September with waits of 2 weeks or longer, but was running more smoothly until late December when demand spiked. The rapid tests are intended for regular screening, not for diagnosing if SARS-CoV-2 is causing your symptoms. Rapid tests are in short supply nationwide, and the state is working with test manufacturer Abbott to try to obtain more, Bookman said. The state also is seeing if other companies could deliver a similar product in the near future, he said. We simply don't know if they have any available, he added. And speaking of COVID, we have this brief from the Associated Press. Battling surge, Summit County reimposes mask mandate. Dateline Breckenridge. A tourism-dependent area in Colorado's mountains has reinstituted a mask mandate because of a growing number of COVID-19 cases. People will have to wear masks in public indoor spaces in Summit County, home to several ski resorts. In a news release, the county's public health department said the decision was made in response to an alarming increase in cases during the past week. Officials believe that's the result of the highly contagious Omicron variant. The county and the Aspen area have among the highest incidence rates in the U.S. Summit County leaders had been reluctant to reimpose a mask mandate, partly because it would put service workers in the difficult position of enforcing it, the Summit Daily reported. However, they also were concerned about the number of workers who have had to quarantine and saw the move as a way to help businesses. To me, it's just a really common sense approach and something we need to take to help mitigate this, even if it's minuscule in what it does, County Commissioner Elizabeth Lawrence said. And we have this bit of news from the Vail Daily. Vail Day of Lyft ticket at $239. Single-day access to Vail Mountain cost $239 on Wednesday for those purchasing Day of Lyft tickets. For a ticket for both Wednesday and Thursday, the cost was $478. It's a new high for single-day ticket pricing at Vail. Last year, Lyft tickets hit $229 per day during the holiday season as Vail competed with Deer Valley in Utah for highest single-day Lyft ticket price in the nation. John Plack with Vail Resorts said new terrain openings have helped Vail avoid implementing day-of pass sales limitations. "We've had a great end to December with feet of snowfall and more terrain openings, including the Back Bowls," Plack said. Vail reported snow continued to fall throughout the day on Thursday. And we have another brief related to our lead story about the devastating fires in Boulder County. Boulder County wildfires, how to help those affected. More than 35,000 people have been forced to evacuate their homes as two wildfires spread across Boulder County. Here's how to help them. Community Foundation Boulder County is collecting monetary donations for those impacted. Donations can be made at comfound.org. The Boulder Office of Emergency Management said people who can offer shelter to displaced residents should sign up online to become a vetted host through the Airbnb Open Homes program. The program will contact people if needed. Donations of household goods should be taken to local nonprofit thrift stores, according to the Office of Emergency Management. And if you lost or found a pet, a Facebook page called Boulder County Fire Lost and Found Pets has been created for people to share information. People are also offering to take in pets. Others with the capacity to shelter or relocate horses and other livestock are posting in a separate Facebook group called Horse Evacuation Boulder Fort Collins Fire. The Office of Emergency Management asked people not to call their emergency lines to offer donations. They need to help keep those lines clear. And that was by Elise Schmelzer of the Denver Post. In related weather news, Arvada. Six injured as strong winds collapse tire store, by Aldo Sivaldi of the Denver Post. Strong wind gust caused a discount tire store at West 64th Avenue and Sims Street in Arvada to collapse like a house of cards late Thursday afternoon. There were six people that were treated on the scene for minor injuries, and two were transported to the hospital, said Amber Jones, a public information officer with the Arvada Fire Protection District. Crews worked to stabilize the building and treat the injured in what met the definition of a mass casualty event. But all of the wounded could walk, and injuries were minor despite the severity of the collapse, Jones said. Photos on Twitter show damaged cars and debris strewn across the parking lot and a roof that had completely shifted off the collapsed building, with the Discount Tire marquee sitting flat on the parking lot. The National Weather Service in Boulder forecast that wind gust could reach 40 miles per hour in Arvada, but it clocked gust at 115 miles per hour at Rocky Flats, which is 6 miles north and west of the damaged tire store, and 98 miles per hour at the White Ranch Open Space, which is about 10 miles west of the location. A dashboard cam shared on Twitter captured the moment when a severe gust ripped the roof apart and collapsed the tire store, capturing a panicked employee running out as a metal roof panel flies through the air and crashes just above him on a nearby building. An Arvada fire engine responding to a call near Rocky Flats had a relatively new windshield severely damaged and blown out by the debris that was flying in the air, Jones said. And we have another take related to today's lead story. Weary evacuees head to North Metro shelters, by Joe Rubino and Judith Kohler. Scores of people rushed to evacuation sites Thursday night, fleeing fast-moving fires in Boulder County, Superior, and Louisville. At the First Bank Center in Broomfield, a Green Day song played softly on the speaker system, while a handful of evacuees sat in the seats around the arena's lower bowl on Thursday night. The music venue turned evacuation center had welcomed about 30 people as of 5 p.m., Detective Aaron Coleman of the Broomfield Police Department said. More trickled in while some sat in their cars in the parking lot. Superior resident Patrick Kilbride, 72, was among the people gathered around the arena floor. He was still wearing his green vest from McGuckin's Hardware in Boulder, where he works. He lost everything but the clothes on his back and his car in the fire, he said. Kilbride was on the clock when he heard that Holmes and Superior were being threatened. It took him 3 hours to get to his house. He parked his car and covered the last stretch on foot, hiding behind a stone pillar for close to an hour at one point to avoid getting blown over by the intense wind, he said. It's ashes, he said, of his home for the last 30 years. It's not a house. If you need a fireplace chimney, that's all that's left. Roscoe, Kilbride's 16-year-old dog, and Dusty, his 20-year-old cat, both died in the fire, he said. On his way to the evacuation center, Kilbride stopped at a Walmart and bought socks, underwear, and a phone charger. He went into the bathroom to wash the soot off his face. His daughter was driving up from New Mexico to be with him, he said. He expects to spend a lot of time on the phone with insurance companies over the next few weeks. It's just a strange feeling to go from having everything to make your life comfortable to having nothing, he said. Evacuation centers were set up at the First Bank Center at 11450 Broomfield Lane, the YMCA of North Colorado at 2800 Dagny Way in Lafayette, and the Longmont Senior Center at 910 Longs Peak Avenue. Early in the evening Thursday, people continued to arrive at the YMCA in Lafayette, one of the evacuation centers. Outside, the wildfire smoke to the south was dense. Inside, families, couples, and single people sat on the floor and on chairs in the lobby where a lighted Christmas tree stood. Jeff Oliver, a YMCA employee, said local businesses donated pizza, sandwiches, and water for the evacuees. Nearby, Pam Allen's cell phone rang. It was her sister in North Carolina calling to check on her. The Lafayette woman assured her sister she was all right. Allen, with her cat, Allie, in a carrier next to her feet, was sitting at a table in the gym. My next-door neighbor who looks after me said, "Grab some things and go," said Allen, who is on oxygen. Allen gathered medicine for herself and her cat and food and a bowl for the cat, and she grabbed a blanket on the way. "I have enough for the night," Allen said. Praying, that was Alice Santman's response when asked how she and her daughter, Holly Santman, were doing. The Santmans live in Superior, hit hard by wildfire burning along the Front Range. They left their neighborhood about 2:30 p.m., bought some food, hung out with their dogs in a park in Westminster, thinking the winds would die down and they could return home. They eventually went to the Lafayette YMCA. They know homes burned in a subdivision north of theirs. They don't know about their neighborhood. We were watching the news, and it felt like what we would watch when fires happen in Southern California, Alice Sandman said. And you're like, why would they live there? Now, here it is. By 6:45 p.m., about 75 evacuees had gone to the First Bank Center, officials said. One man stood by the check-in station drinking a bottle of water. His face, hair, and clothes were covered in ash. The building was not expected to host evacuees overnight, Broomfield Police Detective Jennifer King Sullivan said. I don't think we have the showering ability and all that, she said. She wasn't sure where people might be sent next. Pizza was en route to feed the evacuees and volunteers in the meantime. Karen Jolowski, 61, sat near her three grandchildren as they filled in pages in coloring books by the arena floor. Am I going to have a home to go back to? The grandmother said of the thoughts going through her head Thursday. Jolowski and her husband, Bob, live in an apartment in Superior. Their son, daughter-in-law, and the grandkids are visiting for the holidays and were hanging out at their hotel nearby when Jolowski said she smelled smoke in the air and turned on her TV. At first, it looked like the fire was headed away from their building, but then the winds turned southward, and they knew it was time to go. About 4 p.m., they loaded their Australian Shepherd, Harley, into the car, and the family headed to the First Bank Center. This is brand new to us, Jolowski said of the fire. We just moved here 2 years ago. Our hearts go out to those that lost their homes. We haven't lost ours yet. State Representative Tracy Burnett was among the many people who took needed supplies to the Lafayette YMCA on Thursday night to help people who sought shelter there after being forced from their homes. The Louisville Democrat said she had to evacuate her home. "This is absolutely devastating," Burnett said. "I know these neighborhoods." Burnett said there will be more catastrophes unless something is done about climate change. "This is the result of the climate crisis. We are it," Bennett said. Where and How Much Snow to Expect on New Year's Eve by Jake Shapiro of the Denver Post. Denver is almost certain to get its second snow of the season over the next few days. The storm will be the first time this season that a significant amount of powder will fall downtown. According to the National Weather Service in Boulder, Thursday's winds served as an appetizer to what's coming in the mountains, as light snow and blowing snow will make travel difficult on Friday. Denver will end 2021 with a snow day, forecasters say. There's a 50% chance of snow, mainly after 11 a.m., with about 1 inch expected to fall. Winds will stay gusting over 20 miles per hour. As the calendar turns, the temperature will plunge to 11 degrees overnight, and the snow will pick up. The chance for snow increases to 90% Friday night, with an accumulation of 3 to 5 inches downtown. In the mountains, snow will continue through Saturday morning, with 2 feet possible across Rocky Mountain National Park and the Park Range. There will be difficult travel conditions statewide Friday night, with the snow slowing Saturday. Along with the flakes, frigid temperatures, with wind chill reaching below zero Friday night and Saturday night, will move in with this storm. A high of 19 degrees is forecast for downtown New Year's Day, with a 60% chance of snow mainly before lunch. Saturday night will see the mercury fall to 1 degree. Those hitting the slopes or going for a weekend getaway in the high country need to be prepared for dangerous driving conditions. That means possible below-zero temperatures and feet of new snow on back roads. Temperatures will begin to warm up Sunday, with highs in the 40s and climbing back into the 50s by early next week. Denver Airport's top lawyer resigns. He says physical demonstration at holiday party was a mistake, by John Murray of the Denver Post. The top lawyer for Denver International Airport resigned this week amid a city investigation into his behavior at a recent holiday party for DIA executives. Scott McCoy, DIA's general counsel, acknowledged during an interview Thursday that he got physical with another attorney, one of his subordinates, during an impromptu demonstration of a police interaction that apparently caught the other guy off guard during the December 16th event. He called it a mistake to touch anyone without getting their consent. But he disputed a CBS 4 report that characterized the level of the violence this week, saying he didn't realize until the next day that his actions were perceived by the other attorney and others to be inappropriate. He said they did not appear to accept his apologies. The other attorney involved declined to comment on Thursday. "I didn't want it to continue to be a distraction," McCoy said, so he submitted his resignation, which takes effect on Saturday. His conduct had drawn scrutiny from the Denver City Attorney's Office, which appointed him to the post at DIA. The dual role is considered an executive vice president-level position at the airport. He started the job in early May, overseeing an airport legal staff of 18. Jacqueline Davis, public information officer for the city attorney, issued a statement Thursday saying the office promptly investigated the unfortunate incident that took place at DEN's holiday gathering. She confirmed that McCoy had resigned and said because this is a personnel matter, the CAO declines to provide any further comment. The incident played out in a matter of seconds during the evening party at a hotel near DIA, which drew airport CEO Phil Washington and other high-level officials. McCoy said he joined several people in a casual conversation about police use of force practices and some calls to defund the police in the wake of high-profile deaths of people in police custody in recent years. While he discussed the importance of police de-escalation techniques, McCoy said, he decided to engage in role-playing to illustrate his point by modeling how a person might resist arrest and provoke an officer, a situation that would require strategic thinking on the officer's part to defuse. It's a topic he's passionate about, he said. So he turned to the other airport attorney, McCoy said, and touched him repeatedly on his upper torso, waved his hands at the other attorney's face, and shouted. McCoy acknowledged that he caught the other attorney by surprise, but he disputed that he violently slapped the colleague in the face multiple times in a way that nearly knocked him out of his chair. That is how the CBS4 report on Monday characterized his conduct, citing an unnamed source. McCoy told the Post he'd had very little alcohol to drink and was not intoxicated. Absolutely not. My recollection is that I was touching the other attorney on the shoulder, and I was also waving my hand really close to his face, McCoy said, before adding, I shouldn't have touched anybody without making myself really clear. That was a mistake. Turning to business news, King Soopers Grocery Workers Plan Vote on Strike by Judith Kohler of the Denver Post. With just a few days left in the contracts and a handful of bargaining sessions to go, the union representing employees at Colorado's two largest grocery chains say that it will hold votes to strike against King Soopers for what it says are unfair labor practices. The United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7 said Thursday the decision follows a series of moves it says amount to unfair labor practices by King Soopers. Kim Cordova, president of the union, on Wednesday assailed the company's release to employees and the media of a proposal on pay and benefits that did not include concessions that union members would have to make for the higher pay. The strike votes are scheduled for Sunday in Denver and Monday in Colorado Springs. Workers would stay on the job until January 9th, the day after the union's contracts with King Soopers and Albertsons expire. The votes are separate from the contract being negotiated and would not apply to Albertsons, which owns Albertsons and Safeway stores in Colorado. However, Cordova said Albertsons and Kroger, which owns King Soopers and City Market stores in Colorado, are seeking concessions from workers, even as workers' lives have been upended by the pandemic, and the industry has reported record profits. The workers have been on the front lines, just like healthcare workers. They're the critical link to the food supply chain, Cordova said. Instead of coming in and sharing their profits, the companies have come in asking for outrageous concessions. The companies have proposed limits on the amount of sick leave that people can accrue and take annually, and they want changes to overtime pay, Cordova said. Union members also are concerned about pay, a lack of adequate staffing, the outsourcing of jobs, and safety as coronavirus cases surge again, she added. From the point of view of the union, it's really convenient that their contract is up now, because this is a moment when labor has a lot of power in the labor market, said Jeffrey Zaks, an economics professor at the University of Colorado. Zach said he was surprised that companies would seek concessions from workers in the middle of labor shortages and a pandemic. This is the least favorable time for employers to take a hard stand that I can remember in my professional life of 40-odd years, he said. Labor has flexed its muscles across the country as the job market has tightened, and millions of people have quit their jobs or failed to return from furloughs as part of what's been called the Great Resignation. Workers at Kellogg Company plants recently ended an 11-week strike. In Colorado and four other states, Nabisco workers ended a strike in September and approved a new four-year contract with parent company Mondelez International. Early in the COVID-19 outbreak, grocery workers were designated as essential employees. The large companies gave employees an extra $2 an hour in hazard pay, but that ended after a couple of months. Two union-covered employees at Safeway Albertsons have died from COVID-19, and five employees at King Soopers have died. Altogether, more than 2,000 employees for the two chains have tested positive for the virus since the pandemic began. In a federal lawsuit filed Tuesday, the UFCW Local 7 accuses King Soopers of violating the current contract by using third-party staffing services to do union-covered work. King Soopers declined to comment on the lawsuit. The union represents about 17,000 grocery employees in Colorado and Wyoming. It is negotiating separately with Kroger, the largest supermarket chain in the state and the U.S., and Albertsons Companies, which acquired Safeway in 2015. Negotiations with Albertsons, Safeway, and UFCW Local 7 are progressing, company spokeswoman Chris Staff said in an email. The company has met four times with the UFCW Local 7 and will go to the table again January 6th and 7th. Kroger spokeswoman Kelly McGannon said the company is willing to work with the union as long as it takes to reach an agreement that is good for the employees. But Kroger's announcement Wednesday of a proposal for new spending on wages, health care, and pension plans, including more than $145 million in pay over the next 4 years, drew a harsh response from Cordova. She said Kroger's statement to the media and employees omitted concessions workers would have to make, such as higher health care premiums and reduced benefits. Because these changes would no doubt hurt our members and their families, Local 7 members have opted to turn down this offer, Cordova said in a news release. Kroger said its offer would have boosted more than 75% of the employees' average hourly wage to over $18, with more than 50% making over $20 an hour on average. Sandy Chavez, a 38-year Safeway employee, called the company's proposals a gut punch. "I know how negotiations work. I've been through several of them," Chavez said. "But after 2 years in a pandemic and grocery workers having sacrificed and some having sacrificed with their lives, I'm so angry with these companies." The last strike by grocery workers in Colorado was in 1996. Union members at King Soopers walked off the job, and Safeway and Albertsons eventually locked out union members. That strike lasted 42 days. Grocery employees in Oregon went on strike against the Kroger-owned Fred Meyer and Quality Food Center stores on December 18th. They returned to work the next day after reaching a tentative settlement, the Oregonian reported. Cordova said Kroger is making preparations to hire temporary replacement workers in case of a strike in Colorado, and showed the Denver Post a copy of a flyer advertising jobs for $18 an hour. She said the company advertised for temporary workers in Oregon as well. McGannon said Kroger isn't looking for replacement workers in Colorado, but is taking steps, including printing signs, in case of a strike. We do have an obligation to provide our community access to fresh produce and essentials. Union members at King Soopers and Safeway said the idea of paying replacement workers more than many of the current employees get is insulting. The businesses we used to compete with for this pool of workers, they've all upped their pay by multiple dollars per hour. That's why we're having a hard time attracting new workers into our stores, said Matt Sturmom, who has worked for Safeway for 18 years. Kenny Sanchez, who has worked for King Soopers for 10 years, blamed the wages for staffing shortages. Hobby Lobby is paying $18.50 an hour to start. I've seen Target signs that are stating people that are starting people at $19.50 an hour plus a premium, said Sanchez, who works at a Broomfield store. The hard money is no longer at King Soopers. Kroger spokeswoman Jessica Trowbridge said the company has slightly fewer than 2,100 openings in King Soopers and City Market stores across Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah. She said in an email that although King Soopers is not immune to the labor shortages affecting industries nationwide, it is committed to doing all we can to recruit and train talent to support our valued associates. U.S. grocery sales jumped by 11% in 2020, more than triple the growth of the previous 2 years, the U.S. Census Bureau said. Financial filings showed Kroger's operating profit was $4 billion in 2020, up from $3 billion in 2019. Albertsons reported sales and other revenue of $16.5 billion in the second quarter of 2021, compared with $15.8 billion for the same period in 2020. We have quite a few obituaries and memoriams in today's paper, so I will read the basics from those. Patterson McDonald Bonero, born March 21, 1931, and died August 17, 2021. A celebration of life will be held on Thursday, January 6th at 1:30 p.m. at St. John's Cathedral on North Washington Street, immediately followed by Patterson's Partridge Party at the University Club on Sherman Street. There will be champagne and show tunes. Memorial contributions may be made to the Denver Dumb Friends League, the Denver Woman's Press Club, or St. John's Cathedral. John Lawrence Devitt, born September 27, 1925, and passed away on December 7, 2021. For full obituary, please visit Stork Bullock Family Mortuary. And that address on the web is www.sbmortuary.com. Bernard Katz of Denver passed away. He was the husband of Shanna Katz, father of Terry Orlovsky and Peggy Zimmerman, grandfather of Paige and Alex Zimmerman, Brian and Jill Orlovsky. Also survived by his sisters-in-law, Renee Heller and Judy Vad. Memorial service Sunday at 10 a.m., Temple Sinai, masks and proof of vaccination required. Live stream will be available on Temple Sinai website. And you can make contributions to Temple Sinai. Dr. Margaret La Tourette, born September 30th, 1923, and died December 7th, 2021. Peggy was raised in New York and attended Bernard and New York medical colleges. In 1945, she married Verne La Tourette. He would become a radiologist and she a pediatrician. She married Chuck Willis in 1993. She is survived by four sons, Steve, John, James, and Thomas, four grandchildren, and two great-grandsons. A reception will be held at her home at 624 South Oneida Way in Denver on Sunday, January 2nd from 1 to 5 p.m. For a full obituary, go to fairmountfuneralhome.com. Joyce DeVore Slicer, born August 11, 1932, and died July 21, 2021. Born in Denver, she was married to George A. Slicer, an officer in the U.S. Air Force. Ann Joyce is survived by her son, 3 stepchildren, 6 grandchildren, and 4 great-grandchildren. William Alvin Tex Moncrief, Jr., born March 27, 1920, and died December 29, 2021. Tex was born on the kitchen table in Hot Springs, Arkansas, the eldest of 2 sons of William Alvin Monty and Elizabeth Moncrief. He was preceded in death by his father and mother, brother Richard Bartow, wife Deborah Beggs, and 3 children, daughter Monty Francine, sons John Herbert and Charles Beggs. He is survived by his wife Linda, sons W.A. Moncrief III, Richard Wesley Moncrief, and Tom Oil Moncrief, stepchildren Debbie Johnson Ryan and Dr. Harold V. Johnson, and numerous grandchildren and great-grandchildren. A private family service will be held at the Moncrief Mausoleum in Greenwood Memorial Park. Memorials in lieu of flowers, should one desire, charitable gifts may be made to the Moncrief Cancer Institute in Fort Worth, Texas, St. Andrew's Episcopal Church, also in Fort Worth, or a charity of your choice. Hildy Newman of Denver passed away. Her life partner was Ralph Constantini. She was the mother of David Newman, Joanna McFarland, Jessica Newman, daughter of the late Morton and Rose Buchalter, sister of the late Eugene Buchalter, grandmother of Jackson and Sam McFarland, Jasper and Griffin Newcuff. Graveside services Sunday at 2 p.m. at Golden Hill Cemetery. A live stream will be available on Feldman Mortuary's YouTube channel. Dorothy Sutton, born September 8, 1927, and passed away on May 28, 2021, after a lengthy period of declining health. She was born in Bedford, Pennsylvania. She was predeceased by her 2 brothers, William and Robert, and 2 sisters, Margaret and Jean. Dorothy married H.C. Hal Sutton in 1954, and he predeceased her in 2008. She is survived by her children, John C. Sutton and Catherine E. Sutton of Denver, Colorado, granddaughter Lillian S. Griffin of Katona, New York, and 3 great-grandsons, Weston, William, and Jack. She taught in the Denver Public Schools for 35 years old. Funeral services were private. And returning to news, Maxwell verdict bodes ill for Prince Andrew's U.S. civil case, Dateline London. Prince Andrew wasn't on trial in the Ghislaine Maxwell sex trafficking case, but her conviction is bad news for the man who is 9th in line to the British throne. With the conclusion of the Maxwell case, attention will now turn to a U.S. lawsuit in which the plaintiff alleges Maxwell and longtime boyfriend Jeffrey Epstein took her to London, New York, and the U.S. Virgin Islands to have sex with Andrew when she was underage. Andrew denies the allegations, but Wednesday's verdict shows that at least one American jury was willing to believe the young women trafficked by Epstein and Maxwell in a criminal case, where the standard of proof is higher than in civil cases. To the extent there's overlap of evidence with respect to Prince Andrew's case, it certainly doesn't bode well, said Bradley Simon, a former U.S. federal prosecutor who now works as a defense attorney in complex civil cases. But, as I said, every case hinges on its own specific facts, and the judges will always instruct the jury on that. Maxwell was convicted Wednesday of sex trafficking and conspiracy charges after a month-long trial in New York. While U.S. criminal cases must be proved beyond a reasonable doubt, civil defendants can be ordered to pay financial damages if they are found responsible based only on a preponderance of the evidence. The verdict is problematic for Andrew, because he has long been friends with Maxwell, daughter of media tycoon Robert Maxwell. Even after Epstein was charged with sex crimes, Andrew failed to distance himself from her. Those links have diminished the prince's standing. He was forced to give up his duties as a working royal after a disastrous 2019 BBC interview that only increased public concern. The prince was criticized widely for his explanation of why he maintained contact with Epstein and for failing to show empathy for Epstein's victims. And that story was from the Associated Press. Tiger bites arm off man reaching into enclosure. A man who worked for a cleaning service at the Naples Zoo in Florida was seriously injured Wednesday when a tiger bit his arm after he went into a restricted area and reached into the animal's enclosure, authorities said. The first sheriff's deputy to arrive at the zoo kicked the tiger enclosure and tried to get the animal to release the man's arm from its mouth, but was forced to shoot the Malayan tiger, the Collier County Sheriff's Office said. The zoo said the 8-year-old tiger named Eco, which it had acquired in December 2019, had died. Preliminary information indicates that the man was either petting or feeding the animal, both of which are unauthorized and dangerous activities, the sheriff's office said. Thank you for joining us for the Friday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Tammy.